An engineer in Ukraine's Zaporizhia nuclear power plant speaks with VOA.
And eyewitnesses' confirmation, very clear confirmation, that Russians have placed military equipment on the territory of the plant.
Plus, why is Turkey deepening its trade relations with Russia? And later in the program,
the international community is struggling to be able to keep its focus on all these different challenges all at once, right? When this crisis of Ukraine is put on top of that, it becomes overwhelming for our international leaders to be able to manage.
So what needs to be done to address the humanitarian crises that extend beyond just that of the war in Ukraine? Today is Friday, August 26th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. Ukrainian officials say a mission from the United Nations International Atomic Energy Agency is expected to visit the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant next week after it was temporarily knocked offline. Zaria Shackley from the Associated Press starts us off as more shelling was reported in the area overnight.
Fire damage to a transmission line at Europe's largest nuclear plant caused a blackout across the region on Thursday. Lana Zerkal, an advisor to Ukraine's energy minister, told Ukrainian media on Thursday evening that logistical issues are being worked out for the IAEA team to come to the Zaporizhia plant. Zerkal accused Russia of trying to sabotage the visit. Ukraine has alleged that Russia is essentially holding the plant hostage, storing weapons there and launching attacks from around it, while Moscow accuses Ukraine of recklessly firing on the facility. I'm Zaria Shakili.
The state nuclear company, Enerhoatom, said that one reactor block of the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant has been reconnected to Ukraine's power grid. The company also underscored that there are currently no issues with the plant's machinery or its safety systems. Enerhoatom also added that electricity for the plant's own needs was currently being supplied through a power line from Ukraine's electricity system and that work was ongoing to restore grid connection to the plant's two functioning reactors. An engineer working under Russian occupation since March the 4th at the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant told VOA that Russian forces have placed artillery and missile installations within and around the property of the plant. They themselves have caused explosions near the plant in an apparent attempt to discredit the Ukrainian military. That information is gleaned from an exclusive interview the technician had with VOA's Georgian service. VOA Georgian service managing editor Ya Mermishvili worked on that story.
So the main takeaway from the interview was that this is an eyewitness's account and eyewitnesses' confirmation, very clear confirmation, that Russians have placed military equipment on the territory of the plant, and Russians have shot out of the plant or have used the plant as a military establishment or military foothold of some sort.
And how did the service, you know, verify the claims? Because the plant is under Russian control. The IAEA has still yet to be able to visit the plant. So what kind of corroborating information was provided to back up the claims?
Some of the claims have been reported by the Ukrainian media even before this. And there were at least two other interviews that we saw of similar nature, one by Ukrainska Pravda and the other one by BBC. And those accounts are pretty much not identical, but that's the only non-Ukrainian government information that we have to kind of corroborate the account. And we know the source and we trust the source.
VOA continues to protect the identity of the source because of the situation, but have they shared what they are most concerned about?
I would say it's threefold. They are concerned about that it would be a disaster or nuclear disaster. The second thing I would say is overall occupation of the plant and of the region. And the third aspect I would say is that it's difficult for them to understand how it was possible not to protect the plant in a way that Russians would not take it and occupy it.
VOA Georgia service managing editor Yarmouk-Mirishvili. The latest intelligence update from the British Defense Ministry said that on August 24th, Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu told the Shanghai Cooperation Organization that Russia was deliberately slowing the pace of its military campaign in Ukraine, driven by the need to reduce civilian casualties. The ministry says that's likely deliberate misinformation. The update added that Russia's offensive has stalled because of poor Russian military performance and fierce Ukrainian resistance. On Friday, the Ukrainian military said its forces had repulsed Russian assaults on the towns of Bakhmut and Soledar. Those are located in the eastern Donetsk region. They also struck ammunition depots and enemy personnel in the southern Kherson region. Joining us with more is Anna Chernikova in Kyiv.
The main updates we have from Kherson region and from Luhansk region. So according to the Ukrainian armed forces, the ammunition depot was destroyed next to Chernobyl in Kherson region. Once again, it's already more than 20 times that Ukrainian forces destroyed that kind of Russian depots, and in this area in particular. Also, it was another hit of Antonovsky breach, which is not functioning anymore. And just now we get information that another breach in Kherson was also damaged, very heavily damaged, and is not operating anymore. The shelling was happening again in the Donetsk, Mykolaiv, Kharkiv, Zaporizhia, and Dnipropetrovsk regions. A lot of civilian areas were damaged and civilian infrastructure were damaged. Some people died and more people are injured, but again, we don't have final numbers. Also, Ukrainian forces had quite a successful attack in Luhansk region. Ukrainian armed forces killed about 200 Russian paratroopers in occupied Kadivka in Luhansk region. Reportedly, Ukrainian forces hit the Russian base in the Donbas Hotel. For the moment, we know that reportedly HIMARS systems were used in this for this attack. Also, according to the head of the Luhansk Military Administration, Serhii Haidai, this base was used by Russian forces from the beginning of this war in 2014.
Anna Chernikova in Kyiv, Ukraine. We'll also hear from Anna again later in the program. You'll find additional updates on the war throughout the day by visiting our website, voanews.com/flashpoint. Turkey is deepening its trade relations with Russia in the face of Western sanctions against Moscow. Dorian Jones reports Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan could be relying on Russian support to help ease Turkey's growing economic woes as he faces re-election next year.
Aiding Russia's construction of a nuclear power station in Turkey was the reason cited by Moscow for the recent transfer of $5 billion to Turkey, with reports that $10 billion more are coming in the next few weeks. The infusion of hard currency is a welcome boost for President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, whose 2023 campaign for re-election is dogged by a plunging lira and inflation at nearly 80%. Timothy Ash is a senior strategist with Blue Bay Asset Management.
By helping Russia get around sanctions, that Turkey can earn key balance of payments receipts from that, and that will help support the lira, rein down inflation, and help him win the elections.
To safeguard his close ties with Vladimir Putin, Erdogan has refused to enforce Western sanctions against Russia. Earlier this month, at the Black Sea resort of Sochi, the two leaders held talks on further developing trade ties. Turkey has doubled Russian oil imports since this year's assault on Ukraine. Russian oligarchs continue to moor their super yachts in Turkish marinas, knowing that Turkish authorities won't attempt to seize them. Analysts say Erdogan has become a valuable Putin ally. Maria Shangina is a specialist on international sanctions at the Institute for Strategic Studies.
Turkey has de facto become a black knight to Russia. In academic literature, that means a state that is willing to help a sanctioned country, at least to mitigate sanctions. And this is where Russia sees Turkey in that light, that it can come handy in terms of developing its economic ties against the background of Western companies fleeing the country.
Turkey and the United Nations have brokered a deal to export Ukrainian grain to world markets, and its export operations are based in Istanbul. Erdogan claims credit for the deal, saying it was only possible because of his close ties with Putin. But analysts warn that Putin may seek to leverage Erdogan's relationship and growing dependency on Russia to circumvent Western technology sanctions, putting Ankara on a collision course with its allies. Attila Yeşilada is an analyst with Global Source Partners.
To me, the game breaker is high technology. If I understand it correctly, both in civilian area and in military area, Russia is denied high technology that is really hitting their supply lines. And if Turkish companies are used to import proscribed, I suppose that's the word, proscribed items to re-export to Russia, that will blow the game open and Turkey will be sanctioned.
With Turkey's economy in a weak state, sanctions analysts warn would trigger a devastating financial crisis. At the same time, analysts say Erdogan is placing his bets on Russia in the hope that Russian trade and support will revitalize his nation's economy ahead of next year's elections. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. Daniel Speckert is a former U.S. ambassador to both Belarus and Greece. He's currently the president of Chorus International, which is a non-governmental organization that works with communities to help them recover from both natural and other disasters. Yesterday, we chatted about how he sees the current situation in Ukraine 6 months into the latest war there. Now, in part two of the conversation, we discussed the war's impact on global humanitarian issues. I want to ask you about some things in the humanitarian sphere where the challenges are there, because there has been a lot of focus on the refugee crisis that this war has sparked. And you brought up the numbers earlier, but that adds to the huge number of refugees that previously existed. So given that there's some global food insecurity, some areas on the cusp of famine, what challenges face the global community in addressing not only food insecurity, but the refugee crisis and other issues and natural disasters as a whole, as the global economy is in some areas booming and in some other areas, facing stagnation?
Well, I mean, you hit the nail on the head. This Ukraine crisis couldn't happen at a worse time, in the sense that the world had already been rocked by the environmental crisis of climate change that has really put millions and millions of people in vulnerable situations from droughts, floods, and pestilence. And then they got hit by COVID, right? That has disrupted supply chains around the world. Even in developed countries, you see groceries not stocked the way they should have. Imagine what that's like maybe in a smaller town, regional town in Mali or Uganda or Haiti, as those supply chains find their ways. Those countries find their way themselves last in the supply chain. So the world had already been in a dire situation with over, as you mentioned, 100 million people displaced in the world. Now, since March, another 70 million people have been pushed into poverty because of the war in Ukraine. There's about 48 million people facing emergency levels of hunger. And this has an impact, really in the lives of women, children, and families. About a million kids a year die of malnutrition. That number is only going to go up as a result of this, as food insecurity grows. And the most vulnerable people are always the ones who suffer the most. So what I'm worried about, Steve, most is that the international community is struggling to be able to keep its focus on all these different challenges all at once, right? You can handle one or two crises at a time, but handling the crisis of global pandemics, of environmental challenges of a historical level, of hunger, of acute malnutrition and, in fact, in some places, pending starvation. When this crisis of Ukraine is put on top of that, it becomes overwhelming for our international leaders to be able to manage this in a way that addresses all these challenges. So I think the most important thing is we need to be very firm and push back hard on Russia to ensure that Ukraine's situation stabilizes quickly, that they understand that there isn't a long-term solution here if they just wait it out, and that they do come to the negotiation table, that the peace is allowed to develop there while a longer-term solution is determined that will give the Ukrainians their freedom and independence in a more permanent way. In the meantime, the longer we wait, the more people suffer, not just in Ukraine, but around the world.
And speaking of the world, my last question to you is this, and this is on a broader geopolitical stage, because you already mentioned that moving forward, Europe is going to have to recalculate its relationship with Russia based on its current actions toward Ukraine. But globally, you know, you see Moscow and Beijing being closer to in their ties. You see some countries on the African continent abstain or not condemn Russia's latest actions in Ukraine because they have very close ties with Moscow. What do you see geopolitically happening in the future as the war continues, given that there are countries who are trying to distance themselves from Russia and those who are trying to maintain close ties?
Yeah, I think the challenge here is going to be understanding how China plays this strategic positioning in the coming days and months and years ahead. From China's perspective, obviously, they're probably pleased that the United States is distracted globally and focused on Ukraine crisis. And we also have in our own political elections coming up here at midterms and stuff that gives them opportunities around the world to further reinforce their position and their relationships with countries, oftentimes at the expense of the United States. They're probably pleased that Russia is more dependent on them than they have been in the past. They would like to see Russia as a junior partner to them. At the same time, China has to be very careful and walk a careful line because Europe is a very important potential trading partner for them. And the sanctions that have been implemented on Russia can sometimes have broader impacts for third countries if they're not careful about how they maneuver in those systems. So I think over the long term, this isn't in China's interest. In the short term, they may make some progress in terms of positioning themselves vis-a-vis the United States. For the United States and Europe, I think this is obviously a very discouraging turn of events. At the same time, I think it's solidifying the unity of democracies and those who hold certain values in the world that has to do with human rights and freedoms. And that over the longer term, the strength of that unity is going to show itself up in the world in a positive way that perhaps has been missing in recent past. And so I'm actually hopeful we'll see some positive things come out of this as people rally around the Ukrainian cause and understand how important these values are, that people have the right to self-determination, and that these idea of human rights and the killing of civilians is just a reprehensible in any context, that what had looked like, you know, a great weakness of the United States following the pullout in Afghanistan, I think the rest of the world is seeing strength again and backing up these values.
Ambassador Daniel Speckhard is the president of Chorus International. He's also a previous ambassador for the United States to both Belarus and Greece. Ambassador, thank you very much.
That was a great conversation, Steve. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me.
In Ukraine's Zaporizhia region, many kindergarten buildings have been turned into refugee centers welcoming Ukrainians from less safe areas of the country. Katerina Markova brings us that story.
Thank you so much. I didn't expect this. I've heard volunteers are amazing. I just can't. It's giving me shivers.
Many residents of occupied cities in southern Ukraine, like Mariupol, Kherson and Berdyansk, arrive in Zaporizhia and spend their first night in this kindergarten center. It's called Kindergarten Veselka in Ukrainian, which translates to Rainbow Kindergarten. They arrive in buses, about 100 people at a time, from filtration centers. Here they are given food, a place to shower and a comfortable place to sleep. Kindergarten director Natalia Kuzmenka is often there to greet them.
There is so much adrenaline. We feel that there is so much we need to do for these people to make them feel welcome. We make sure everyone has food or a coffee, and they're off to Lviv, and from there to Poland or wherever they're going.
Natalia is staying here and told of her ordeal.
It's very difficult. 2 months in hell. There was no electricity or gas, there was little water, and last week it was all gone.
Other refugees said Russian troops moved into their town and made it impossible to stay.
They got drunk and started fighting, shooting at each other. I have 3 children, but I have never seen anything like it. And he says, "We came to protect you." And I said, "From whom? From whom did you come to protect me?"
Displaced persons stay just one night before moving further, but they find great relief during their brief stay.
We did not expect such a warm welcome from people, neither did we expect aid.
For staff and helpers, it can be overwhelming.
This is how we cope. We just cry. At home, you start telling your loved ones about it. It's just horrendous. No one here knows even half of what is going on there. This is just complete torture of people. Here, at least for a bit, they feel warmth and care.
So far, the center has helped more than 2,000 people searching for safety and stability as Russia continues its war on Ukraine. Katerina Markova for Voice of American News, Zaporizhia, Ukraine.
Since the beginning of the full-scale Russian invasion, more than 100,000 children have been born in Ukraine. That was previously promised. Anna Chernikova is back to round us out, having visited a Kyiv maternity hospital that's been doubling as a bomb shelter and where new parents are embarking on a fresh journey of hope.
Since the beginning of the full-scale Russian invasion, more than 100,000 children have been born in Ukraine. They are to form the country's new generation amid a war that shows no signs of ending. Mikita and Artem were born during the worst of the Russian assault on Kyiv. Today their home is still under constant threat, but they are growing and bringing joy to their parents, who are adjusting to their new role and the reality in which they will have to rear their children. This maternity hospital has been working non-stop since the start of the Russian assault. It specializes in premature babies, and its staff members are saving the lives of newborns every day. Doctors say the facility is operating almost normally again, after adjusting in February to treat potential war victims if needed. Darina Shpin and Irina Cherko spent the last days of their pregnancy and the first days of motherhood in the bomb shelter.
I woke up on the 24th of February, a minute before the explosion. Then I saw from the window that people were fleeing somewhere and everyone was texting that the war had begun. We couldn't go anywhere because I understood, where would we go? Giving birth in a field? No, we had to stay at home. I never thought that I would see my child for the first time in a bomb shelter. Can you imagine?
We had an emergency bag. It was always with us. My husband was here guarding the perinatal center, protecting our lives, mine and the baby's.
Doctors say they were impressed with the courage of the young mothers.
We should be proud of our women. I really admire their endurance and the way they behaved.
Now, half a year into the war, these babies are close to taking their first steps into a future that is uncertain, but for their parents still filled with hope. Anna Chernikova for VOA News, Kyiv, Ukraine.
And that's going to do it for us this week. On behalf of the entire team at Flashpoint Ukraine, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.